You're listening to The Hawk, 101.5 FM, broadcasting across Hamilton from the edge of the Niagara Escarpment.
You're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 The Hawk FM out of Hamilton, Ontario. My guest tonight is Kai Welch. Kai is originally from Oregon and is now a Nashville-based songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and producer. He's known for his work with Grammy winners such as Abigail Washburn and Casey Musgraves. He's been nominated himself for several Grammys in 2013 for Best Folk Album, co-writing five tracks for the Green Cards album Sweetheart of the Sun, and most recently in 2020 for Best American Roots Song as a songwriter on Sierra Hull's Ceiling to the Floor. He was nominated for Album of the Year at the International Bluegrass for the International Bluegrass Music Association for his production of Molly Tuttle's album Rise. Kai's work has earned him many fans in many corners of the world, including an admirer and world-class banjo player, Bella Fleck, who describes Kai as a powerful music force. He's scored everything from films to web series to TV commercials, and his love for music and nature has also led him to start Music for Wild Places, a nonprofit concert series that takes participants on multi-day musical adventures through some of the world's most beautiful wilderness areas. So welcome to the show, Kai.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. I look forward to chatting tonight. So let's start off the show with a song of yours. So you've released two studio solo albums, the full-length Send It Down and the self-recorded and produced Perpetually Out of Fashion EP. So let's kick off the show and listen to the song Perpetually Out of Fashion out of the EP by the same name.
Thank you. What if you were a rose too? When my faded old and used up, then what do we do? Every day's like a new sensation. Don't get caught out in the clothes you used to wear. The body's moving to that place you heard about. Girls are walking that new walk. Seen a move quite like this, rolling easy with our pockets full of dough. Yeah, yeah, whoa. I'm addicted to my hesitations. I'm a phony, be the first to admit. I'm offended that we are not naked. Yeah, yeah, whoa. Clouds burst for the first world problems. Baby's gotta get a pill to solve them. It's hard to eat this well and still stay hungry. Yeah, yeah, whoa, 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 whoa. It's just the same old news. Sit back and watch the wheels go roll. It's just the same old news. Sit back and watch it.
That was Perpetually Out of Fashion by Kai Welch. Kai is my guest tonight on Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. So Kai, that song we heard is off your self-produced and recorded album called Perpetually Out of Fashion. And for those listening that want to get that album, you can get it on Bandcamp, and that's at kaiwelch.bandcamp.com. Kai is spelled K-A-I and Welch is W-E-L-C-H. So Kai, you played almost every instrument on that album?
That's what is known as a bedroom EP. yeah, I just made that kind of for fun in my room, in my bedroom.
And how many instruments do you play?
Oh, I don't know. I only play one instrument legitimately. Like if I had to walk into a music school and tell the music school kids that I play an instrument, I would say that I play the piano. Cause you can't go around Nashville, Tennessee saying you play the guitar, because then everybody is better than you at the guitar. Like your pizza delivery boy is going to like, so I play the piano. I'm a keyboardist.
I've seen you play banjo. You play everything.
I don't know what the Canadian version of the FCC is, or if I would get in trouble, but I F around on other instruments.
And so when you what was the first instrument that you learned like growing up? So like I've seen you played, well, when we first met, actually, I was looking into this. We met in 2008, actually, which is about 12 years ago.
It was auspicious.
And we met at Austin City Limits, and you were playing in a band called, with Bobby Bear Jr. And I knew Chris Masterson, who was playing guitar in that band.
Correct.
And you played trumpet as well in that band, correct?
I did. I did toot a few notes. Yeah.
And so did you study music at all in school, or like were your families musicians or?
So my background is I loved the piano since I was tiny. My mom, she's always talking about how I would stand there in my diaper and bang away, but I've like figured out a chord when I was like three and I'd play that same. I don't know. Who knows? We can't believe my mom. But I played the piano all the time growing up and got, heavy into like classical nerddom in the piano world, and I loved the piano. I still love the piano, classical piano. So I went to I did go to school and study classical piano performance for a couple few years at the University of Oregon before I realized quickly that it just wasn't for me. But I played the trumpet in the high school marching band, and I was required to be in the high school marching band because they wouldn't let you be in the music program at all in my high school unless you were in the marching band, because that was their tactic for getting, otherwise there would be no marching band. Nobody wants to be in the marching band. But so yeah, I picked the trumpet so that I had a lightweight instrument. I figured it was loud and obnoxious and lightweight. So yeah, I played the trumpet in high school, and then I kind of forgot about it until I got to Nashville and I realized that there's not a lot of trumpet players in the indie rock scene in Nashville.
And how long have you been living in Nashville now?
15 godforsaken years.
Wow. And so what, so after you finished university or college, whatever you call it in the States, you went, so you traveled the South Pacific.
I had a little rambling phase where I fancied myself quite the little adventurer. So I did end up in the South Pacific a little bit somehow or other. I kind of like hitchhiked my way onto some sailboats with some yachties, which is, I actually think that is the real term, yachties. They have a whole, there's a whole like culture of these people who just cruise around on their yachts, and they're kind of like bougie dirtbag people. Mm-hmm. Which was great. I loved that. But this, yeah, God, that was so long ago. But yeah, I traveled around for probably the better part of a year or two. And, I was talking to my friend about this, totally unrelated today, but, the reason I came home was because I hurt my tooth. I was trying to chew my way into a coconut, which is so stupid. If you know what a coconut is like, it's got a very hard shell. And I tried to chew the hard outer shell of a coconut to get to the delicious inside meat. And I hurt my tooth. I think I ended up having to come home and get a root canal. And that ended my adventure.
Don't they normally open coconuts with machetes?
Yeah, you're supposed to have a tool going all the way back to prehistoric times. But I tried my own. I was trying to do it my own way. Anyway,
Did you go to Nashville as part of the band, or looking to kind of start a band there? How did that come about?
I came to Nashville. At the urging of my cousin Satchel Paige Welch, who said, "You've got to come and play in this band with me," and I was still at the age when you would consider doing a thing just because it sounded like it would be a good story. So I was like, "Yeah, I'll go over there for a couple of months." I thought maybe a couple of months max. And then I would go back to the Pacific Northwest, and me and all my friends could talk crap about the South and how backwards and horrible it was. That was my plan.
Right.
But didn't go as planned because that was 15 years ago. I ended up staying.
And I think you've done pretty well for yourself. You've got quite the resume under your belt here. So you,
I've been lucky and I have met a lot of people who I love, you know, and who I love to make music with and hang out with. And like, that's kind of how all the good stuff happens.
Yeah. Let's listen to a song called If I Wasn't, from an album you produced. The song's by Ashley Campbell and Vince Gill, and then we'll come back and we'll chat a little bit about it, okay?
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. such a fool, I'd let you walk out that door. Find out what living is for. If I wasn't such a dreamer,
Ashley Campbell and Vince Gill, and you're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. My guest tonight is Kai Welch. Kai, you produced that album this year. So I read that you produced the whole album in 10 days. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, those kind of statistics are always questionable because it depends where you're putting the start and the end. We did track it in 10 days. So we spent, you know, we probably spent months going back and forth on songs and working, you know, working out parts and song selection and, you know, figuring out who's going to play and where we're going to do it and what, blah, 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 all the stuff that goes into producing a record. But then we did track the record in 10 days, which was a little bit of a whirlwind because I was on tour all the time at that time with Casey Musgraves. And so we had 10 days off for Christmas and we tracked it during Christmas, basically.
And so the artist on that, so that's Ashley Campbell. And so she's the daughter of Glenn Campbell, the country music legend. And so she was also, and Vince Gill, who's a huge American country singer as well, was on that.
I haven't heard of Vince Gill, but Ashley.
You haven't? Or are you kidding?
I'm
kidding.
No, Ashley. Yeah, Ashley is royalty, and I mean, her dad Glenn Campbell is just like so, you know, such an amazing. I didn't know that much about Glenn, honestly, before meeting and starting to write with Ashley years ago. But there's a great man. If anybody out there in Radioland hasn't seen the documentary, I'll Be Me, the Glenn Campbell documentary, it's supremely worthwhile. I was like blown away by this guy. Mostly his sense of humor. The dude is hilarious and an incredible guitar player. I did not know this about Glenn Campbell. Everybody kind of knows that he had an amazing cleft chin and looked like an oil painting, but nobody knows that he was hilarious and shredder, like could play the guitar like to beat the band. So anyway.
Yeah, that's a beautiful song. And did you play guitar on that song as well?
I did play guitar on If I Wasn't. I played the guitar I played the guitar and played the producer.
Nice.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the non-for-profit that you started called Music for Wild Places. It's pretty fascinating. So I guess for to give folks a bit of a background on it. So basically it's where you have kind of multi-day music excursions into parts of the world that like are pretty wild. So can you give us a bit of background on like what made you start it? And maybe we'll start there.
Well, Music for Wild Places was kind of like a no-brainer thing for me. I was just, honestly, it was selfishly motivated at first because I spent, you know, most of my young life a lot of time in the wilderness, very closely connected with and passionate about, I guess, being outside in beautiful places. I mean, I grew up in Eastern Oregon, which has some gorgeous little mountain ranges and a big canyon called Hell's Canyon, which is the Snake River Gorge between Oregon and Idaho. And anyway, the gorgeous part of the world. And, you know, that was just always has been one of the most important things to me is to get out amongst it. And it feeds me and like makes me not go crazy. And I think it's spiritually good. It's just good for people in a lot of ways. So Music for Wild Places was an idea that happened because I was, you know, I was in my first few years of touring and I think I was, well, I remember exactly where we were. I was in Norway with Abigail Washburn, who I toured with for a long time. And you know, we were on this like whirlwind tour, which is just how it goes. You're just on tour. You know, you got one day where you arrive in the city. You got one day where you might be able to take a walk and find a croissant and whatever. And then you do the gig and then you get some beers and then you blah, blah, blah. And then the next day you probably get up and go again because the itineraries are, that's just how it goes. And I remember the feeling of being in Bergen, Norway, which is like, you know, ridiculous, like something out of a Lord of the Rings trilogy, and looking around and realizing like I legit had 2 hours of time in this place, this part of the world that I've never been to before, likely never, might never go back to. I had like 2 hours and I like was sprinting. I like ran through the town to the edge of town and was just dying to get into these mountains. But I couldn't because of the nature of touring. So I thought, you know, I need to like come up with a way to get musicians out into the, to put together the two things that I love the most, which are, you know, playing music and being outside. And, so there was a very simple solution to that because I used to be when I was in college, my summer job was as a whitewater rafting guide. And so I just called up my old buddies, my old company that I used to work for, and they run a fantastic guide outfitter service out of Eastern Oregon. And truly, like, they're, these dudes are world class dudes and dudettes, like amazing, amazing team of people. So anyway, they were like thrilled with the idea. They're like, yeah, sure, you can bring, you know, terrific artists out on the river, and we'll set up a trip, and we'll do everything, and you guys just come, and we'll figure out how to keep your instruments from getting sodden or baked in the sun or whatever, and we'll make it happen. So basically, that's what Music for Wild Places turned into, was river trips. More than anything else, it's been river trips. I think it could go anywhere. I think the idea of having musical performances happen in the wilderness, in like true wilderness, where you actually have to, you've got to work and get out of your comfort zone to get there. Mm-hmm. And then experiencing music in those places is like the core concept of Music for Wild Places. And at this point, it's not that you, there's a lot of other organizations and groups and people who are, I'm not the only one in the world who had this idea, more or less. Mm-hmm. I thought I was at first, but you know, like with any idea, you ain't the first. But yeah, it's been amazing. We've done countless really, really cool trips, including one trip to Tibet a few years ago that was kind of life-changing for me. And so yeah, it's turned into a cool thing.
Yeah, and actually, for those just joining, you're listening to Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk, and Kai Welch is my guest, multi-instrumentalist, producer. And Kai, you actually wrote a fantastic article that I read about that trip to Tibet, and it's on the Patagonia website. So for those that want to read it, it's called Beyond Words, Singing for a National Park in China, I believe is the title of the article. And
that sounds familiar.
Yeah, and it's really, really incredible article, and like there's some really cool parts of that like, can you talk a little bit about the stones that you spoke of in that article?
Oh my lord, yeah. Tibet. It's just like that place like shattered my brain and my heart. Mm. It was so cool. But technically, I'm supposed to call it Eastern China, but I'm not going to for the purposes of this interview. But yeah, we were in a city. We started in a city called Yushu, and there's one of the largest collections of Mane stones, I think they called them there, which is so the one of the like core principles of Tibetan Buddhism is the mantra Om Mane Padme Om, like, which is the classic it's a prayer for compassion for all living things. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's, you know, if you ever see sort of like Tibetan scrawled onto a thing or painted onto a whatever, it more likely than not it's that prayer. And it's everywhere in Tibet. I mean, it's everywhere. It's all, they like paint it onto the sides of the mountains. They carve it into the ice. They put, it's what's on Buddhist prayer flags that are, you know, that are so popular at head shops all over the world. It's sort of like ubiquitous in Tibet. And so they paint these stones, they'll actually carve, they'll pick up a rock, like a fist sized rock, or like a, all the way up to like a dinner plate or even tiny. And they'll carve those words in there, those characters in Tibetan into the rock. And then they'll paint them these beautiful, like vibrant colors. And then when they're done very Tibetan fashion, they take it, set it on a pile of other identical painted rocks and go find another rock and start carving and painting again. Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose is just to send out compassion to all living things. And when they, so I didn't even know this before I went there, but like the concept behind a Tibetan prayer flag is that the wind will blow the prayer for compassion for all living things down, you know, across the flag, off of the flag, down the canyon, out into the valleys, into the whole world. they'll carve that same prayer into the ice of a river in the winter so that when it melts in the spring, that compassion prayer will float downstream and be carried off to all living things in the world. I mean, I had never conceived of a culture that could be based so purely on like the actual desire for compassion and like the idea that you could spend your whole life like carving and painting stones in the hope that you might increase the level of compassion in the universe. It's like, it broke my heart. And everybody, you know, who I was lucky enough to take that trip with, I mean, we were all just like, we were all in tears the whole time. It was ridiculous.
And there was a music component to that trip as well, correct?
Yeah. So that trip came about, that was really interesting and kind of weird like life is, but that trip came about because a friend of mine who I went to college with, but frankly didn't know very well in college, his name is Travis Wynn, but we have a lot in common. We were both river guides. We were both whitewater rafting guides. He was a very serious, amazing, sort of like world-class kayaker. And he started going to China in the early aughts, I think. And he started to see what was happening in China, which was that a lot of these amazing rivers, some of the most beautiful and high-quality whitewater rivers in the world, were getting dammed and disappearing. And you know, the Yangtze River, the Yellow River, these large famous rivers got buried in, you know, huge public works projects in China behind these massive hydroelectric dams. And they're not just burying the canyon and the whitewater, but they're also burying like, or drowning, however you would want to describe that, you know, thousands of years of culture, and temples and carvings and settlements. And so Travis made it his like life's work. I mean, he cared so much, let me put it this way, that he ended up in the psych ward for a time. He lost it. I mean, he couldn't bear to watch and stand by and let this happen. So he paddled a few last descents, which is kind of like ironic because often in the kayaking paddling world or skiing or whatever, you kind of get kudos. You get good marks for a first descent, right? So somebody gets the FA is the shorthand slang. It's the same in like the mountaineering world, but if you get the first ascent of a route up a mountain, okay, that's cool. Well, he was getting a previously unknown distinction, which was the last descent of several rivers before they were dammed. Mm-hmm. And so he named his company Last Descents, which is a whitewater guiding company. And he started to try and change the narrative in Eastern China, AKA Tibet, that, you know, these rivers could be worth more than just hydroelectric and water resources. They could be worth something as an actual source of tourism, you know. Well, and the deeper story is that they're worth something on their own. You know, that's the thing that humans have a real hard time grasping, and we desperately need to come around on this. But you know, which is that wilderness and wild things and wild places are valuable on their own. We don't have to assign value because they are worth something to us. But anyway, that's I could go down that rabbit hole for a long time. But he made the local people there see that they could actually make money on ecotourism, running river trips, and that was kind of revolutionary to them. And then anyway, I'm going off here, but basically what happened was the local Tibetan government really trusted him. He was really like embedded there, and he'd worked with them for years. And China decided to open a national park system in China, which is kind of cool. Everything, you know, everything that happens in China must be taken with a bit of a grain of salt because it's just such an such a crazy place. But they are opening a national park system, and they are basing it, they're modeling it after the U.S. national park system. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to kind of throw a big party for the grand opening of the first Chinese national park, which is going to be, it's called the Headwaters of the Three Rivers, and it's out in that province. Oh Lord, I'm blanking on the provincial names right now, but anyway, it's incredible. It's the headwaters of the Mekong and the Selway and Salween and two other rivers, and it's just really a cool place, an incredible place. So we got to go and celebrate the opening of this national park and put on a music festival.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
To make a long story long.
So actually, I wanted to touch on another project that you had. So it's called the Wu Force.
Mm, speaking of China.
And so that's yourself. It was Abigail Washburn and a Beijing musician, I believe, as well.
A musician named Wu Fei, who's originally from Beijing. She plays a 21-string Chinese zither called the guzheng.
What's a zither exactly?
It's like a harp laid on its side with no metal frame. It's a wooden harp, and it has an individual movable bridge for every string. It's super crazy, but the way that I can describe it that people understand is it sounds like kung fu. It's the sound of kung fu movies. If you picture a kung fu movie and then you picture the moment when it's like the like where somebody's gonna do, that's a guzheng. And I'm not probably pronouncing it right, because in Chinese you have to pronounce it guzheng. That's probably closer to the correct, but
let's listen to a song from the Wu Force called Paper Absolutely. Lanterns, and then we'll come back and we'll chat a little bit more, because I'd like folks to hear the music, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it. Okay,
cool.
Thank you.
That was Paper Lanterns on 101.5 FM The Hawk by a band called The Woo Force. I'm joined tonight by Kai Welch, who was a member of that band. And so that band was made up of Abigail Washburn, who's known for many music projects, such as her string band Uncle Earl. Her and Bella Fleck won the 2016 Grammy for Best Folk Album. Kai, who's joining us tonight, and then another artist, a Beijing artist named Wu Fei. Is that correct to say I'm pronouncing?
Yep. Yeah, Wu Fei.
Okay. And so we were just talking before the song played about just some of the musical components of it. And so I guess my question is, so how did the three of you come together, and where did you record this album?
Well, Abby and I were on tour in China a bunch of years ago. Abby has a whole China thing, and I won't go into that whole world, but for those who are interested, they can Google Abigail Washburn China and you'll learn a lot. But she loves China and wanted to take me to China and has the ability to tour in China. So we went over there, and she just had an old friend in Beijing. She was like, "You've got to meet Wu Fei. We're going to have such a good time." And we met up in her apartment in Beijing, which was like, in a 30-story apartment building above one of the busiest ring roads in Beijing.
Really?
Beijing's built around this ring road system. And so it was like one of the smoggiest, busiest, craziest places.
Really?
I had ever been in my life. Fei, so in China, your first name goes last and your last name goes first. So Fei is her first name, Wu Fei. And so Fei spent many years in the U.S. studying music. And so she's more or less, I mean, she's very Chinese, but she also has strongly Western ideas. And she is an incredible musician and really just like a spunky lady. She's hilarious. So we hit it off instantly. I loved Fei. I loved hanging out there and hearing her take on China and her feelings about her own country. And so we found Abby, Fei and I just found that we had a lot in common. We were able to tap into something. And so we wrote that song, Paper Lanterns, and several other songs the first few days that we spent together in that apartment in Beijing. Yeah, we might have partaken in some herbal remedies and just kind of gotten weird. And it was truly weird, very much a weird project, but it was so fun and satisfying. And you know, that gets the overall sort of thesis statement of that project is just like trying to bring super disparate, different elements from around the world together. And like, what, where is the common ground? What do we all share? What do we all feel? What makes us human? Which I think is actually, as I'm saying that, I'm realizing it's probably more apropos than ever at the moment. But Paper Lanterns was a song about a mother who had gone to work in the cities. And this is a very common story in China. And she wanted to see her babies, but she couldn't. She didn't have the money. She was in the city working some kind of probably menial job, making money to send home to her parents and her children. And she wants to see her kids, but she can't. And so the Chinese portion of that song that you heard Wu Fei speaking, she was reading a letter, an imaginary, fictional letter that she wrote as a mother to her children saying, maybe not this year, but I will come back to you. And so Paper Lanterns is like sending up the love to your family and watching it float away and then hoping desperately that you can see them again. So
now that's really beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. I want to play another song that you played on. So you mentioned Abigail Washburn. So you also played electric guitar and you sang on, she had a bandmate from Uncle Earl named Arena Gellert. Is that the right
how to pronounce it? Oh, yeah.
Rena. I really love this song. It's called Grey Bird. So maybe we'll play that and then we'll come back and chat a bit, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Grey Bird by Rena Gellert. You're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk out of Hamilton, Ontario. I'm Mary, and tonight I'm talking with Kai Welch. And Kai sang and played guitar on the song that you just heard. Rena, so she's spent a lot of her life playing string band music. I've read that, but then ever she's like performed and with such a range of people, everyone from like Robin Hitchcock to Loudon Wainwright III to John Paul Jones.
John Paul Jones loves Rena. JPJ loves Rena.
That's wild.
Well, Rena is hard not to love. Rena is like she's a total anachronism. She's like she stepped out of another century. She really belongs like in some like homemade clothes in the dust bowl, like playing fiddle, like off the back of a broken down T Model Ford or something. She is such a genuine article. And the way she plays the fiddle, which I guess that didn't happen at all in the song we just listened to, Grey Bird. She doesn't play the fiddle in that song, or honestly, hardly at all on that record that we got to make together, Working's Too Hard. But her fiddle playing is what she's really, really sort of, you know, widely acclaimed for. But she's also an incredible songwriter. And she hadn't done that much of that. She was in that band, Uncle Earl, with Abigail and other. It was like a girl string band, and it was a big hit, you know, everywhere they went. And she, I'm sure, had a hand in the writing of those songs. But over the past handful of years, she's put out a few solo albums, you know, quietly, and it's a specific scene, I think, of folk music that really has that audience, you know, and who would know and listen to Rena. But man, I think that she should be 100 times as famous as she is, because I just think, and this record was really cool to make. It was, I'd never made a record like this before, but it was myself and Raina and a wonderful, multi-talented older, can you edit that out? I didn't call him older. Kieran, I did not call you older. Well-respected musician, Nashville musician named Kieran Kane, who, so it was, and then one of my best friends, a drummer named Jamie Dick. So it was the four of us, and we sat in a circle in the studio, very close together, with a handful of microphones all turned on at the same time. Nobody was in any kind of a booth. There were no headphones. There were no edits. There were no overdubs, and there were no redos. We just played the songs. And because of that, I think that record feels really special. It's like so much music nowadays is like, you know, heavily produced and pieced together and whatever. And we all do it and it's fine. And it's okay. It's the way it's the, like a lot of times it's the way things get done. But this was such a special experience to just sit there and make music really together, like no headphones. It was the coolest.
Cool. Awesome.
I'm going to start recording audiobooks.
You should.
I am doing
it. Oh, like, you are?
I'm doing it. I signed up already.
Like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, because I love reading out loud. And I think it's going to be so fun.
How do you get into that?
Well, you have to just like do it. At first, you have to like record a bunch of samples and then you upload them to this like main website where people go to try and find readers for their audiobooks. And then you just kind of sit there and cross your fingers for however long. And then
really? So it's kind of like a real, it's like a, like an acting reel, but for voice.
Basically. Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Cool.
It's like, yeah, you like go to the casting call and just like cross your fingers.
Oh, you know what? I knew what I wanted to ask you. I saw in your bio that you recorded a song for Sesame Street.
Oh, yeah, I did. Well, that was like through my roommate. My roommate, Heather Bond, is also a wonderful musician who I love very much. And she had this brief from Sesame Street, you know, and the way these things work is they'll kind of send a brief, which is a description of what they're after, out to several different people. And I read the brief and I thought, well, we can do that right now. Come on into my bedroom studio. And so we made this little song called I Is for Instruments. And it's like Cookie Monster like eats his saxophone at the end, and like Animal keeps like falling off the drum kit and breaking everything. It was awesome though. It's really fun. And so the country band Little Big Town ended up performing that song on the show on the HBO Sesame Street. And I wrote it, and they basically used our demo that we made in our bedroom for the final show too. And it was funny because then years later, Casey was actually opening for Little Big Town. It was the first tour I did with Casey. We were opening for Little Big Town. And so I got to, you know, mention that backstage at a certain point, like, hey guys, you can remember when you were on Sesame Street.
That's
that was
awesome.
My song.
So what's your favorite venue that you played with Casey? Like, you must've played some, did you play Wembley Arena?
I mean, I don't know. It would have to be between Madison Square Garden and the Forum, I would say, because both are just suit my needs as far as size and capacity. No, I don't know. My favorite venues. Okay, I can answer that question because one of my favorite venues is a theater in Dublin, Ireland. I want to say it's like the Orpheum or something, but it's not. It's so cool, and it's just old school, and the crowd, it's all about the, you know, a venue's only as good as its inhabitants, but people were like losing, they were like doing soccer chants while they're cheering for
us,
and it just felt amazing. So that was among the best. And then the other best gig that I'll never forget in my life was we got to play this festival in South Africa, in Johannesburg, South Africa. at the soccer stadium, like, so this huge, massive stadium, and there were 76,000 people there who had all been given tickets for free. The way you got to go to this festival was you had to prove that you did a certain number of good deeds.
Really? That's so cool.
It was so cool. And Oprah was the MC, and Beyonce and Jay-Z and Pharrell, and like, it was so cool. And it was commemorating
Mandela?
Yeah, that guy.
I was like, that guy.
It was incredible. And they kept playing like video and audio clips of him, of Nelson Mandela speaking.
That's a really cool idea to have a festival with that as the, it's probably going to be like a, it's better than having to give a COVID result to get into a festival.
True. That festival was totally incredible, and it raised, like, it's called the Global Citizens Festival, and it happens every year in different countries, and they raise a ton of money for AIDS prevention and other issues. So
let's play a song. Have you been making some music in quarantine here?
No. Not making music. I have my little OP1 on my lap, my favorite mini synthesizer, the coolest toy ever invented. But I'm keeping myself entertained.
What kind of synthesizer is that?
Oh, this is called an OP1.
OP1. Is it a new or old? Like, is that a new synthesizer or an old one?
They probably started making these things 10 years ago or something, I think.
Okay.
Something like that. It's a Swedish company called Teenage Engineering. And it is the most enchanting, fun little device. It's probably got the highest like price to square inch ratio of any musical instrument. It's like very expensive for the diminutive toy lookingness. But it's so cool and so much fun. So I have been making a lot of tracks in my little home studio just for fun. I'm trying to make a track a day as kind of a, to keep myself in some sort of a meditative routine.
That's and cool.
It's a lot of fun. I just love
a lot.
What's that?
I said a track a day. That's a lot to do.
Yeah, I fall short all the time, 100% of the time. But I like, you know, you gotta shoot for the stars, man.
Well, then let's end off the show with something that you made yesterday. And does it have a name?
I think I titled the session Green Stars, in fact.
Okay. Cool.
But yeah, I don't know what this is, or if it is anything. It probably just is what it is. But this is how I keep myself from going crazy.
Awesome. Actually,
this track honestly kind of did drive me crazy. I can say that I couldn't fall asleep for hours after this because it's like a little up tempo.
But right. Well, thanks for joining the show tonight, Kai. It was really great chatting with you. I really appreciate your time. And
my pleasure. Always a pleasure to speak with Mary O'Connell, one of the shining lights of Canada.
Okay, my dear. Well, you have a good night, okay?
You too. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.